Hi, my name is Hussein Rashid. I'm a professor of religious studies at Hofstra University with a specialization in Islamic cultures and a background in Islamic theology.
My name is Rabbi Benjamin Weiner. I'm a working rabbi currently in the New York City area, but soon moving to central Massachusetts. I'm trained as a rabbi, but I also have some background in interfaith work, both Jewish Christian and Jewish Muslim interfaith work.
So, Ben, we've got a question in front of us, which is, do Jews and Muslims worship the same God? What do you think is a good answer to
Well, rabbis always answer yes and no.
that?
Or the answer may be yes with complications, or maybe no with exceptions, I guess is one way of putting it. What I was, I guess, most interested in this question, on one hand, it's a straight theological question that you can answer from a theological perspective, and those vary. On the other hand, it's a question with implications. So one thing that I wonder about when a question like this is asked is who is asking and why are they asking? I know that you've recently written a piece for Religion Dispatches that talked about the question from, I guess, what's described as a Christianist perspective. Certain contemporary fundamentalist Christians asking this question or answering this question in a particular way. I wonder if you would say a few words about that because I thought that was pretty interesting.
Thank you. I think that there is the theological way of answering it, and I think that's a really rich field of discussion. But I think part of the problem is that we turn everything into theology, even when we don't mean to. So, there's been a lot of talk in the Christianist community about do Christians and Muslims worship the same God? And we had this fellow, Lieutenant General William Boykin, who, while in service, said that I knew my God, meaning the Christian God, was bigger than his God, meaning the God of Muslims, with respect to a Somali warlord. Or we hear talks, there's these protests going on at Ground Zero right now, that Muslims worship a monkey God, conflating Hindu theology with Muslim theology and making up all these different understandings of God without having any background in it. And I think it's a politically charged statement. It's a way of saying, oh, they are so different from us. They have no way of being the same as us. And right now this is happening with Nikki Haley in South Carolina in the governor's race. And the problem, as I see with that, is that when you do this pop theology, what you're saying is that, oh, there are multiple gods, and Jesus is just one God, or the God of Christians is just one God of many gods, and Jews have their own God, and Muslims have their own God. And the problem with that pop theology is that all of a sudden you're saying, well, that means Christians don't believe in monotheism. They believe there's more than one God, and these gods are fighting. And that becomes really problematic, at least from a Muslim perspective, because from our perspective, there is only one God. And whether you're Jewish, Christian, Muslim, or any other faith that believes in a Godhead, you are worshiping that same God. There can't be more than one.
Right. So it's kind of a backdoor polytheism.
I think that's a great way of describing it, a backdoor polytheism.
But it's interesting. This is a case in which clearly social and political circumstances are creating a theology that overwhelms more doctrinaire theology or more traditional theology, in which, maybe a purely religious scholar, if there is such a thing, would say, of course, we're monotheistic, but because of the political circumstances, we have these polytheisms emerging. So one seems to be contradicting the other or exerting an influence on the other. Theology seems to be being created by the facts on the ground as opposed to in some more rarefied area or more idealistic area.
I tend to, sorry.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was saying, I think you've hit it on the head, is that it's this politicization, turning God into a candidate, if you will. So we're talking about Jews and Muslims. We're not talking about the platform of Yahweh or the platform of Allah, right? We're saying that, okay, here is our political needs. We're going to say God supports it. And, I'm not voting for God. I believe in God. And I think there's a difference. And God commands me to aim for a better and more just world. And then I'll work with whomever to get that done. As opposed to saying, well, this is what I need to do. God must be on my side. Here's the platform that I believe God would have. let's vote for him.
Well, this is an interesting question. If we go back to the sources in some ways, go back to the sacred texts of the various religions and try to investigate this same dynamic, this in the sources. So just to put it up front, I come from a branch of Judaism that is fine with considering the Bible, the Hebrew scriptures, to be a human document. It varies on some level whether we consider that to be purely human document or a human document inspired by or reaching for the divine. But we very much view the Hebrew Bible through the lens of historical critical scholarship, analyzing where it came from. And so we can see in the Hebrew Bible not a singular voice, but various different theological voices. And that's just the preface for saying that it seems to me that some of these theological voices in the Hebrew Bible do kind of have an our God is bigger than your God voice to them, certain levels of it. So in some ways, unfortunately, I suppose this Christianist thing that you're talking about goes back to something that's familiar from certain strata of the Bible. If the Judeans or the Israelites go to war with the Moabites, it's sort of God versus God. It's like this Godzilla Mothra thing going on above the nations. But at the same time, there are other voices that that speak to a more encompassing vision of God later on, I suppose, like in the prophets and stuff like that. So I don't think that I don't think, unfortunately, that this kind of God versus God is necessarily alien to our cultures. I think that maybe it's a process of selection that we have to be careful about, that both voices are quite available to us from our cultures. I wonder what you think about that.
It's an interesting point, and I think from a Muslim perspective, it's slightly different in that, there are these verses of the Quran, for example, Kullu Allahu Ahad, say that God is one. There's no other but God. As a Muslim, I believe that the Quran is the word of God. But when you look at the text, very little of it is legalistic or narrative. When you look at the Hebrew Bible or you look at the Gospels, there's a story there. Or there's sections that tell you, okay, this is what ritual life is like, or how to build spaces of worship and so on, which really doesn't exist in the Quran in the same way. And so while I believe that the Quran is the word of God, there's some clear guidance, but the vast majority of it is interpretation. And so what are the interpretations we're bringing to the table? When the Quran does talk about Jews and Christians, it says we're worshiping the same God, but Jews and Christians have a very different understanding of what God means, and the debate of whether that's a correct understanding of God or not. But at least from our source text, there's no question that we worship the same God, because there is only one God.
Mm-hmm. Right, and Judaism does have that same information of oneness. We have the Shema, the Shema Yisrael prayer, which ends with the word Echad, which means one. So we do have the oneness of God as a, as a core affirmation of who we are and what we believe. I would ask a question now about particularity in religion. I see on the one hand, if we have on one side of the extreme, this, competing gods, my God is bigger than your God, my God's going to beat the crap out of your God sort of thing. And on the other, we have, I guess, what I sort of call Rumiism, from the poet Rumi,
yes,
who is, Jews love Rumi, at least liberal Jews love Rumi. So we consider him one of our poets also, in a sense, who has, I can't remember the exact words, but the famous poem about the field that's beyond all religions. The basic notion, which is common to mysticism and common to many traditions, that somehow we're all leading to the same thing, which is a beautiful sentiment. And then somewhere in the middle, we have the sense of religious particularity, the sense that so much of what we do religiously is not always about the end point, about the great power that we're all revering and worshiping and trying to, achieve some kind of union with, but it's the particulars of our lifestyle, the particulars of the way we go about that, the particulars of our worship. And so for certain religious thinkers, That stuff is, irrelevant. It's a distraction. It's corruption, I guess, even in the most extreme way of putting it. But for some, mm-hmm. that piece is very important, and that's where identity comes from. And that's how we are who we are as members of a culture. Or it's even the technology, if you will, that we use to access the divine. So those specific pieces are very important. So the question is, in our rush to be universal, do we overlook that piece of things, the particular aspects of religion? Or do we somehow denigrate them or see them as things to be overcome as opposed to sources of identity or even sources of beauty or inspiration?
Well, I think those are actually two separate points. I'm actually a big fan of the particularity of religious traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Again, talking about source texts, there's a verse in the Quran where God says, we created you tribes and nations that you may know one another. And if there was a thing that God wanted us to all be the same, we would be. That if you believe that there's a God who created us, why are we different? And to me, I think looking at various traditions, meeting different people, is a great way to enrich my own understanding of the faith. I grew up in Queens, New York, surrounded by a very large and diverse Jewish community, European Jewry, Middle Eastern Jewry, Persian, and it really helped me understand the own richness in my own faith. Sometimes it's you can't see it because you're so into it, but when you see it in other communities, you understand it better in your own. That didn't mean that if I went to temple with a friend or participated in a Seder, that didn't mean that I was adopting those rituals for myself. It was a way for me to understand who I was and my own understanding of the magnificence of God, our inability to capture that magnificence of God. So mm-hmm. in that regard, I'm actually a really big fan of particularity, but I don't see that as necessarily holding us back from building that common community. And I don't know if that's quite what you were asking in that.
I guess so. I'm wondering, what's the danger of saying that we don't worship the same God? I guess that level of particularity. What if we were just to say we don't? I think Stephen Prother has a book out now called God is Not One.
Yes.
I'm just sort of trying to think what's the force of a statement like that? What's the danger? I on the one hand, we live in an age of global conflict, so the danger is fairly obvious in that respect. People that are saying that my God is bigger than your God aren't saying it in a vacuum. They're saying it with a lot of weaponry. And so that's very clear danger. I guess on a smaller scale, just on the level of coexistence in a multicultural society, for instance. I used to work for this, or I was an intern at this organization called the Institute for Christian Jewish Study in Baltimore. And they had a phrase they used called the scandal of particularity, which was to say that in a society that is multicultural, that sees the virtue and the beauty of living together, like you said very well, I've also been a religious visitor, and it's wonderful to share people's traditions with each other, and it's wonderful to learn about yourself through exposure to other religious traditions and other human traditions in general. But what's the scandal at the end of the day to saying, well, maybe we don't worship the same God? Why is that a dangerous statement, apart from the military explanation of why it's a dangerous statement?
Apart from the military, I think, which is a huge one, I think, again, coming from a very Muslim theological framework, is this idea that then this leads to the idea of multiple gods. I think it becomes really hard then to build that community. It's a great way to create these partitions, and you mentioned Prothero's book, but Reza Aslan also has one called How to Win a Cosmic War.
Mm-hmm.
The basic premise is there is that we turn everything into a battle at the level of the divine.
Mm-hmm.
right? This my God is bigger than your God type thing. Well, that means we can never resolve our difficulties because this is happening at a level we don't play at. We're simply pawns or foot soldiers in this divine warfare. And yes, there's the very strong militaristic side, as you've pointed out, but I think it makes it almost impossible to build that multicultural society. I think even in terms of intra-faith, you know, this is a really big deal within the Muslim community. As you know, Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda affiliates have killed more Muslims than any other people in the world. You know, the main target of their activities are Muslims they don't consider Muslim, right? And what they're saying is that we have this interpretation of God, of Allah. You have a different interpretation. Therefore, you are worshiping a different God, and so we have the right to kill you, rather than saying, well, we can't comprehend God by ourselves being human. We can't describe God in a unitary sense, in one way. So there are all these different ways of, you know, talking about Rumi, feeling the elephant. You know, Rumi has this story, these three men go into a room, it's dark, and they feel this thing in the room. And one says, it's a fan, and the other says, no, it's a column, and the other says, no, it's a rope. And they turn on the light, and one has the ear of an elephant, which is the fan. One has the leg of the elephant, which is the pillar, and one has the tail of the elephant, which is the rope. You know, so we're all feeling the elephant, and we'll never be able to describe it. Mm-hmm. So I think there is this military aspect, but there's also this idea of building for the what we call maslaha, the common good, right? Which you can't do if you say, well, our gods are fighting, so we can never cooperate.
Interesting. So it seems like from what you say that one way of thinking about people's one way of thinking about people's conceptions of God is what possibilities, what space does it create in the material world? So if you have a very fundamentalist absolute sense of God, that's justifying your dehumanization, I guess, of people that don't share that belief. As you said, you know, it gives you the right to kill people that you think disagree with, that don't worship the same God as you. So in some sense, God there is being used as an absolute justification of one's personal view or one's personal existence to the elimination of those that don't share it. And then it's interesting that, you know, a theology of God as unknowable that you articulate, it has the social effect of creating space. Of saying I can't totally put somebody else out of the picture because I don't know in the end what God is. So there might be some way in which God includes that person as well as me. Does that make any sense?
That absolutely makes sense.
Okay.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh, well. So one thing that I wonder sometimes, there's two books that I reviewed in the past year for Religion Dispatches. They both had very similar titles. One of them was called Everything is God by a Jewish theologian, very influenced by Buddhism, named J. Michelson. And the other was called It's Really All About God, I think it was called, by Samir Selmanovic. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his last name right.
Yeah.
So these seem like sort of the anti-books to like God is not great and God is not one. You know, these are the books on the other side of the spectrum saying, no, God is everything and God is super, you know.
Which is funny because Samir still describes himself as an atheist, doesn't he?
He has this kind of coy subtitle in which he calls himself a Muslim atheist Jewish Christian. is what he calls himself, and that's the point. In some ways, at the end of the day, he's Christian. He's Seventh-day Adventist, I believe, is where his affiliation is. But he sort of began with this notion of the big God that we were talking about earlier, the God that leaves space for the other, which is great. It's a wonderful thing. What's interesting to me about it is I wonder if it's in some ways it has roots in tradition, but is this a new theology in some ways? Is this a revived theology that's specific to our time, maybe to America in particular, to sort of the multicultural religious marketplace? a kind of new syncretism almost, in which sort of traditional markers of religious identity don't necessarily hold as much force for a certain generation of believers, and so they seem to be moving towards a sense of commonality based around other principles. I don't know if I'm making any sense right now.
No, I think so. I mean, it sounds like you're sort of reflecting on this whole spiritual but not religious thing we keep hearing about in the last
few years.
I think
so, yeah, on some level, yeah.
And I think I hear you, but, you know, I think as well, you know, working a lot with people of different faiths, doing interfaith work much like you do, is that it is very generational. And I think what's happening is it is the struggle to not necessarily the idea of, oh, how do we make all these different religious traditions get along, but how do we understand our own faith in the context of meeting these different traditions, and how do we deal with questions of modernity, you know, and this is, I think, across the board. Mm-hmm. How do we deal with being modern? How do we deal with this globalized world? How do we deal with having to interact with faiths we've never had to before? And I think the spiritual but not religious label is a bit overblown. I think it's real, but I think it's a bit overblown. And I think often it's the big questions that we don't have a framework for. You know, I'm a big believer that for being one of the most religious countries in the world, the United States being one of the most religious countries in the world, has the weakest vocabulary for talking about religion in the public. You know, what are the two things you're not allowed to talk about in polite companies? Religion and politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so we have these very big religious questions. And that's why we turn to this very weak theology, because it's easier to put it in the hands of God than to struggle with some of these. And mm-hmm. I think historically we've seen this this sort of religious interaction happen before. You know, you look at, of course, the classic example of Andalusia, or Fatim at Cairo,
mm-hmm.
or early Abbas at Baghdad. You know, at one point, what, something like 90-95% of world jewelry lived in Muslim-dominant lands.
Right.
You know, this idea of Muslims and Jews worshipping different gods, or this sort of conflict that we see now, is a very, very modern phenomenon in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's much more modern than the getting along part.
The conflict piece, you think, is more modern?
The conflict piece is much more modern than the getting along
right.
part.
Because you're saying, because there have been points, other points in history where there's been more of a getting along than there is now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Firstly, I was curious what you meant when you said that we have a weak religious vocabulary. You know, what would it look like in America to have a stronger religious vocabulary for talking about issues of theology and faith?
Well, I would hope something like this, you know, where we're sort of saying, okay, it's not about God commanding us what to do, but it's about how do we interpret the faith? What mm-hmm. does ritual mean? You know, you started out, I think, mentioning that you come from a Jewish tradition which holds that the Hebrew Bible is at least partially constructed by man.
Right.
Right? And so, okay, so that tells me that there are multiple Jewish traditions out there. So what are they? And why do you argue about God in a particular way? And we can do the same thing for Christianity, the same thing for Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We instinctively know there's a difference between a Catholic and an Anglican. We may not know what that difference is, but we understand there's this difference.
Mm-hmm.
But if you tell somebody you're Jewish, how many people is the first thought are, okay, well, what school do you belong to?
Yeah.
Right, what movement do you belong to? If I tell somebody I'm Muslim.
Well, they're more curious why I don't have a beard, actually, is the usual first
question. There you go.
Yeah. That's a good point. So we don't have much nuance to our religious conversation in America, you're saying, that it gets simplified or sort of bleached out.
It's very simplified. I think we lack that self-reflexive attitude, that if I know something X about my religious tradition, that I know there are, you know, 7 or 8 major communities of interpretation in the U.S., Muslim communities of interpretation in the U.S. I belong to one. Why would I find it surprising that the other Muslims have a different interpretation? They are of a different community.
Mm-hmm.
Or that Jews operate in the same way, that they have these different movements that, you know, approach God and Scripture in a very different way.
Yeah. Interesting. I guess my fear or my suspicion in America is that a lot of people start to roll their eyes when we talk specifically about religion. You know, we get into all this, they think it's minutia or it's somehow silly or somehow irrelevant. I don't know. Like, I think that maybe this relates to the spiritual but not religious piece that you were talking about, that at the end of the day, maybe religion should help us be friends and feel good, and that's about all we should ask of it. And that to some people, the sort of the pieces of it, the particular parts of it, start to seem a little bit arcane or archaic. I don't know. Not sure. But what I was interested in when you were talking about with this piece is a question that when I was first told that the question for this discussion would be do Jews and Muslims worship the same God, which I suppose we should get back to answering that question at some point. But my first thought was, do Jews and Jews worship the same God? You know,
right.
Before we even get to the interfaith question, like what you said, the intrafaith issue is a fascinating one in and of itself, because I'm not sure what the answer is there. And I sometimes think that certain Muslims and certain Jews are more likely to worship the same God as each other than other Muslims and other Jews. Like the examples that I think about, firstly, what we were talking about earlier about the spiritual but not religious, certain generally liberal and progressive members of various religious communities finding that they have more in common with each other than they do with the fundamentalist branches of their own religions.
Yeah.
And so they might worship the same God as each other or try to find some umbrella conception of God, such as God the Unknowable, that allows them to experience some sense of fellowship with each other. On the other hand, on the other side of the swimming pool, I don't know if it's the deep end or the shallow end, we could debate that, you have the fundamentalists who, although they really don't like each other, really have a lot in common with each other. You know, interestingly enough, when I was living in Jerusalem, one of the few issues that, you know, ultra-Orthodox rabbis and imams could agree on is that they really didn't like homosexuals. For instance, and they issued joint statements on this fact. Actually, every year around the Gay Pride Parade in Jerusalem, there's big issues and even riots occasionally. And around one, you know, the Orthodox rabbinate and I'm not sure exactly what you call the Muslim leadership there, but the imams, they issued a joint statement saying, you know, we don't want this in our city, which, you know, very perversely and very ironically, was a very, you know, beautiful act of interfaith cooperation, you know, in its own sense. So I think they seem to worship the same God as each other on some issues, certainly not on anything, you know, territorial necessarily or
right.
things like that. But there does seem to be a way in which if we are defining belief in that way, in terms of it, again, in terms of its social implications, then yes, Jews and Muslims worship the same God, but in segments, in a way, and some do and some don't. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
And maybe it's a question of orientation. You know, this question of, well, should there be a group of people who can tell us exactly what God is and means? And if you agree to that, well, then you may not agree who should speak for God, but then the people who speak for God tend to be very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that, you know, with a small c, you know, that, okay, homosexuality is bad, women shouldn't be have certain roles in society, that you should learn X languages and eat a certain way and dress a certain way and withdraw from the world or engage the world to make them more like you. Whereas, you know, there's this bottom up that God created, and we can see God through that creation. So how do we understand creation, and how does that give us a better understanding of God?
Mm-hmm.
But again, I would still say that we're still not talking about different gods. We're talking about different ways of understanding God.
Okay.
But I think what happens is that these very conservative, I wouldn't even so go far as to say literalists, at least within the Muslim tradition,
mm-hmm.
But these are, within the Muslim tradition, people who are self-aggrandizing, you know, who think they are, you know, the chosen ones of God. You know, I'm surprised they don't call themselves prophets, you know. Bin Laden in his prime spoke as though he was a prophet. God, I know what God means. Well, if you're that close to God, go into a cave someplace, right? Because we don't believe in prophets after Muhammad. So we're okay ignoring you. But obviously, you know, enough other people were looking for that leadership that he gave it to them.
Right.
And I think that then what happens is you see, at least on a policy front, a lot of people who are sympathetic to that view, you know, Christian and Jewish, who sort of say, oh, yes, what he says makes sense. We are in this cosmic battle and we must fight each other. And so, again, there's this sympathy, you know, it's very top down. I know what God says. I know what God means. And I'll tell you as well.
Right. Agreed. At the same time, I wouldn't want to discount the extent to which on the progressive liberal side, we also claim to interpret what God says. I think it's something that we also do. We make different claims, perhaps. Like we might say, you know, God demands that we end poverty, or God demands that we, you know, support healthcare, or you know, things like that. So I think that it's, I understand what you're saying, but I think that it's not that they make claims for what God and religion says, and we somehow don't. We leave it kind of mushy. We also, I think, make claims.
I think we do make claims, but I think the question is the finality in which we make it. Right? Mm-hmm. In that I'm making a claim, this is the interpretation, this is what I'm pushing, but you're not going to go to hell if you disagree with me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm not speaking on the word. These are God's words, this is what I think they mean. As opposed to, this is what God tells me. I think, and that's a very subtle distinction I'm trying to push.
Okay.
You know, I don't think anybody on the progressive side is claiming to be in communion with God at the moment.
Mm-hmm. I don't, not that I know of.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. It's possible.
It is possible. Anything's possible.
Yeah, anything's possible. Do you have any thoughts? Do you want to ask me any questions or anything?
Yeah, actually, I wanted to pick up this thread, this comment. You sort of put it out there, sort of almost a throwaway line, that religion is there to make us feel good. And, you know, I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit. I mean, is that your position? Is that your community's position? Were you referencing something else?
Oh, firstly, I shouldn't be speaking for any community today. I'm actually in between communities, so I feel like neither one of them should be forced to take responsibility for any of my discussions today. I guess, okay, what was sort of first in my mind, I suppose, is the way that, I guess the way that people, myself included, like yoga or like meditation, things like that, and the extent to which things like that have definitely become a part of a certain class of religious experience, even in Judaism. The sense that, you know, I don't know if people think about it this crassly, but sort of, you know, what's my payoff for participating in this culture? What am I going to feel that makes me feel good? Maybe that's an American or modern way to put it, but the extent to which commitment has to be sensual on some level, you've got to be feeling something good that makes you want to continue to be a part of it. And when you're not feeling good, it's problematic. As opposed to other kinds of religious commitment that still do play a part of religion in many parts of the world, including the United States, I guess. I shouldn't discount the United States, but I guess I was trying to sort of that particular comment came up in the discussion of when we were talking about our religious vocabulary in the United States and how poor it is. And I was wondering if it's because when we start to talk more specifically, people get kind of bored, or they get like, why are you bothering me with all that stuff? I just sort of want to be happy. And that seems kind of arcane. It's like debating how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, or, you know, the difference between one branch of theology and the other, that people don't really, whether it's that they don't have the attention span or that they just don't care, because it's not hitting them where they want to be hit.
Yeah.
I guess that's sort of what I was thinking about when I said that.
Yeah. And maybe this is a good example of that sort of vocabulary. You know, I think we talk about spiritual exercises, and I think that's such a great phrase in English, this idea of exercise that we do for our spirit, for our soul, because, you know, my personal opinion is religion is not there to make you feel good simply by being part of it. Religion is there to challenge you. It's there to train you. And that brings a certain peace. It brings a certain happiness. It brings a certain joy. But simply by doing the ritual, by simply doing something, isn't sufficient. You know, it's not an exercise. It's a movement. To do the exercise, you have to commit yourself. And that's a difficult, difficult thing. Right? You know, the difference between walking to and from work for a mile versus running that mile, and then running that mile in under 5 minutes. You know, that's the difference between exercise and movement. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, doing ritual movement is very different than doing spiritual exercise. Mm-hmm. And so it's not easy, and the payoff isn't immediate, and it's not going to make you feel good right away. But, you know, it's a longer term, I feel better about myself type thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, I think that when we start thinking about religion in that way, then it becomes easier to start challenging ourselves with those difficult questions, because then we are committing to those exercises. Why do you go to a trainer when you go to the gym? Because you can't do certain things by yourself, or you can't do them well by yourself. Why do you go to a synagogue or a mosque? Because there's certain things you can't do by yourself. You need to do with community, or you need to do with somebody who knows more. That was just a bit of an aside, but I really liked
that. Do you think that those spiritual exercises are universal, universalizable? What I'm thinking of is, in Judaism, we have a ritual that we do called putting on tefillin, which is, it's when we wrap those leather straps around our arms in morning prayer. A certain branch of Judaism, the Chabad movement, they're the ones that sort of stand on the street corner in New York and ask, you know, are you Jewish? Are you Jewish? Have you put on tefillin? And they have you put on tefillin if you admit that you're Jewish. Samir Salmanovich, he spoke at RRC, at the seminary that I graduated from, that you taught at recently. And yes. I was told he told a story about...
Sorry, one second. RRC meaning the Reconstructionist...
The Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. Yeah, where I'm a graduate from, and you taught. And I was told he told a story about being in New York and walking down the street, and a Chabad person stopped him and said, are you Jewish? And do you want to put on tefillin? And he said, no, but I do want to put on tefillin. They wouldn't let him. And he said... that's terrible. Why are you leaving me out of this spiritual experience? And so that raised the question, is it a spiritual experience simply just to put a leather strap around your arm? Or to what extent do you have to be involved in the cultural story of the religion in order to, experience the true meaning of the ritual? So I was thinking about that when you defined religion as kind of exercises. You gave kind of an explanation of religious ritual that was pretty generalizable. You know, we all go to our various gyms and we do our various workouts. But there is a level in which, you know, I don't pray like you do, and I don't do the same things as you do in prayer or contemplation. And to the what extent is that local color? And to what extent is that I'm involved in a wholly different, totally different religious story? I guess is what that made me think about.
You know, if I were to extend this exercise analogy sort of off the cuff, you know, let's say I'm a runner and you're a swimmer, mm-hmm. right? And these represent our faith traditions. If I'm training as a runner, I'm not going to spend a lot of time swimming. That doesn't mean I won't occasionally swim to help improve my overall performance as a runner, mm-hmm. right? But my primary focus is on running, and vice versa. You don't necessarily run except mm-hmm. to improve your performance as a swimmer, right? You're a swimmer and that's what you trained for. And, you know, if we look at the religions that way, that I'm committed to these exercises, it doesn't mean that I don't, again, expose myself to other movements, and again, to make this distinction, to other movements or other styles of benefiting myself. But ultimately, I'm committed to one thing. It's, you know, like the football players who do ballet. They don't stop being football players. They don't become ballet dancers. But they're better football players because they've done the ballet. And so I think this question is very much on my mind. I'm actually in Fez, Morocco at the moment. for the World Festival of Sacred Music. And so, you know, you've got, yesterday I saw this wonderful performance of this group called the Baghdad Jerusalem Ensemble, which are these Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews, so Middle Eastern Jews who are performing traditional, you know, Arab Jewish music. And there are all these Muslims getting involved in that space. And what does that mean? You know, to be Muslim and participating in this, you know, some, at least one song was devotional, and participating in that. And the flip side of it is the number of non-Muslims who are here, who are going to these Muslim devotional concerts and participating in that space. Is what is the benefit they're getting? Not knowing the language, not knowing what the ritual movements mean, but they're still participants. And does that help them in any way?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and part of me would like to say yes. You know, just the simple act of exposure has them thinking about their own beliefs in a very different way. Well, why are they doing this, and why do I do that? You know, why do I do something else, and how do they interact?
Mm-hmm.
So I think insofar as, again, it's a way to understand yourself a little bit better and question your own beliefs and practices a little bit better, I think it's great. I suppose my concern is what one of my professors used to call the salad bowl religion. John Levinson gave me this term, the salad bowl religion. You take a little bit of this, you take a little bit of that, you make a nice salad, and that's a new religion. That, to me, you know, I think raises some flags. It doesn't mean that organically we're not going to, or at least some segments of our population aren't going to evolve that way. But I think this consciousness of saying, okay, let's make this one world religion where, you know, on Sundays we'll take communion, and on Friday nights we'll have Seder, and Friday afternoon we'll have Jummah prayer. You know, I'm a little bit, red flags for me.
Okay. How come?
Again, I think it's a question of this, of the discipline. You know, you want to train to be a runner, so, you know, one day of the week you're going to swim, and one day of the week you're going to lift weights, and one day of the week you're going to do yoga, and you're only going to run one day out of the week. It's not really how you train to be a runner.
So it waters down the potential experience, I guess, to make it just a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
Exactly. I mean, when you're doing it consciously, as I said, I think there's a potential for this to happen sort of organically. But I think this sort of conscious, I'll take a little bit of this and make my own practice and make this community of people, I'm a little bit concerned about.
Right. So organically, you mean that there's a way in which religious cultures have always influenced each other and people have always ended up absorbing pieces of this and pieces of that. But that to somehow compile like a greatest hits or a, you know, religion, the good parts edition is
exactly
is a problematic project.
Exactly. Exactly.
One thing I've had in mind, I don't know if this is a segue or just a different thought. In terms of, do we worship the same God in the way that we've been talking about it? I can't help but thinking about the fact that, you know, the whole chosen people thing and Judaism.
Yeah.
So firstly, I just want to put up front that I'm a Reconstructionist rabbi, and one of the main theological moves of Reconstructionism has been to de-emphasize the notion of the chosen people, to say we don't consider ourselves the chosen people in the historical sense. So it's not a piece that I sort of struggle with on a regular basis. We've sort of, in some ways, put that aside as Jews, as Reconstructionist Jews. At the same time, there's some interesting arguments. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who's the chief rabbi of England,
right,
has written some about this, about how in some ways religious particularity ends up being more, I don't know if you would say moral, but maybe that's the word, moral, than universalism, in certain ways. That it's actually, and I'll explain, it's better to say that you are who you are and other people aren't like you than it is to say we're all the same. And I guess the argument goes that, you know, to say that you're the chosen people, it's elitist and it's arrogant. But you're not out there trying to make other people be like you at the same time.
Right.
Maybe there's a better way to phrase being the chosen people. Reconstructionists, we like to say, we consider that we have unique traditions. They're not necessarily better or worse than anybody else, but they're unique. They're different. And Judaism, for a long time, has not been an evangelical religion. People say it was never evangelical religion. That's not exactly the case. We'll go way back to, you know, early days, thousands of years ago, there was definitely Jews were converting people to Judaism. But for thousands of years, it has not been an evangelical religion. And so it's had this this reputation for being elitist, I suppose, in contrast to the, you know, Christianity and Islam that were, you know, more open and universal, saying anybody can be a part of this. But the flip side is that when you have that universalizing tendency, it's almost like you crush the space for the other. You have the potential of crushing the other's space by saying, yes, we're all one, but I don't really recognize your validity until you become like me, like the way that I'm one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I guess why I'm bringing this up is because when we talk about the particular versus the universal, there are certain dangers of that sort by saying we all worship the same God. Because it might just be a way of saying everybody is me, you know?
Right.
Everybody believes exactly what I believe on some level, and that it's actually the space of saying, no, I don't know if that's entirely true, that as long as it's not said in a violent or hostile way, that makes space for other people to have their own conceptions of things and have their own traditions.
Yeah, I think it was in Rabbi Sachs's book, Dignity of Difference, right? Where,
right.
As you said, he talks about this. And I have to admit, you know, I think you sort of highlighted, I think, what the important part of that book for me is that we do have to admit to difference. You know, I feel like I'm beating this sports analogy, but I'm kind of digging it at the moment. I
like
tell
sports.
You.
Go for it.
You know, right. But again, you know, we're going to cross different endpoints as a swimmer and as a runner. Is one endpoint better than the other? We may not end up in the same place, mm-hmm. right? I'm not talking about heaven or hell here, but I'm saying we may end up in different places, mm-hmm. being a swimmer and a runner. But it's still the completion of that arc, of that training we've been doing. Mm-hmm. And I think acknowledging that and sort of saying, yes, we are the same insofar at a meta level, we're both athletes. But at the particular level, no. We do physically different things. We may end up in different places. But we both hold this ideal in common of whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Right? And we can sort of respect the demands on time in terms of commitment, but that we have this overarching commonality. To me, that's, again, I feel that's the interesting part, is that I absolutely see the danger you're talking about. We're all the same. And I think more particularly, we're all the same, so why don't you worship like me? Let me help you along those ways. Particularly, mm-hmm. you know, speaking again from within the Muslim tradition, I think we've had that tendency. It comes and goes in waves, but I think we've had that tendency, you know. Mm-hmm. We are the complete and final of the Abrahamic traditions, the most perfect right. of the Abrahamic traditions. So yes, while I can't forcibly convert Jews and Christians, well, wouldn't it be nice if you saw the error of your ways? Mm-hmm. That absolutely exists. And so, yeah, that danger is very much there. We have seen it and we do see it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Do you have any other thoughts and questions?
Really, I can't think of anything at the moment.
Okay.
Have you got anything? I feel
I'm
like
not sure.
We're really off track, but...
Yeah, I wish I had my outline in front of me. I guess we've talked about many of the things that I had in mind.
Yeah. Well, so there actually is one thing I'm curious about.
Sure.
From a Jewish perspective, you know, we've been talking. You started out premising this conversation with this Christianist, with this response to this Christianist understanding of Islam I'd written.
Mm-hmm.
But is there something parallel? Because I think often when we, at least recently, when we hear about these differing gods, we hear it with respect to Christians and Muslims, particularly in the United States.
Right.
And I think particularly out of certain segments of the evangelical community in the United States. But I don't feel like we get it as much between Jews and Muslims. Do you share that same sense.
Say a little bit more that
we don't hear this, you know, this, oh, well, Jews and Muslims worship a different God. You know, really we hear that Christians and Muslims worship a different God. I mean, do you have the same sense, at least in the American context?
Well, there's a couple ways I would answer that. Well, firstly, is just to remember that for all of our talk about, you know, the three great Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christian, and Islam, Judaism is a very, very, very small group. So on the, you know, if you compare the numbers, it's just kind of almost laughable that we sort of put those three on the same plateau, just in terms of numerically. You know, there are what, like maybe 20 million Jews in the world.
Right.
And that might be an exaggeration, as opposed to hundreds of millions of the others. So for all the fact that, you know, Israel is always in the newspaper, Judaism is a very small group. And
right.
So for some reason, I feel the need to put that on the table, first of all. I think that, and then maybe it's hard to make up a word like Islamist, Christianist, Jewishist, I guess. I don't know what the word would be exactly. But there certainly are fundamentalist Jews, as we all know. In terms of, I guess, the clash of civilizations, which seems to be something of what's going on with this Christianist, Islamist thing, like my God is bigger than your God. It's a funny moment, I think. I think that you see in certain aspects of American Jewry a certain interesting kind of siding with the Christian team right now in certain ways. And most of that is geopolitical, if you think about it.
Right.
You know, this kind of relationship between right-wing Zionism and evangelical Christianity, I guess, is what I'm sort of you know, dancing around right now. So I think that I don't know if that answers your question or not. I think that there are some Jewish voices that I have heard, and that I will, you know, try to dissociate myself from as much as possible, that sort of take up that Christianist line, you know, and say, you know, Islam is the enemy, and that comes straight out of, you know, the Israeli political situation, the Israel-Palestine issue. So I've heard some Jewish voices ratifying that kind of, you know, vulgar Christianist, you know, my God is bigger than your God. You know, Islam's God is evil and terrible and violent and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
On the progressive side, I know lots and lots of Jews that are very eager to find our commonalities with Islam. But in terms of, you know, I don't know. Does this answer your question or does this address your question?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does.
Okay.
You know, and I think it puts it in a really good context as well to help me understand
that element
a little bit better.
Yeah, there was supposed to be no kumbaya sort of element to our conversation, but I've always felt that I've always been fascinated by the extent to which I think Jews and Muslims have certain religious similarities with each other.
Yeah.
You know, I think that I don't know if this is worshiping the same God, but in terms of religious practice, you know, the way that we're, you know, we don't have a human God as part of our religion, we have a prophet or prophetic figures.
Right.
The way that we are very much centered around a text and
yes.
Legalistic and scholarly interpretation of that text, and also poetic involvement with that text. You know, the way we both have, you know, trouble with graven images and pigs, you know.
Yeah. Our friend,
you know,
the pig.
Yeah, right. Both tend to wear beards, except for me, as I said. And I guess I don't think you have a beard either. So it's not that I'm trying to do the end around Christianity either. We have plenty, you know, plenty of interaction with Christianity too. But there's a way in which I've been fascinated by the, at least the surface connections between Judaism and Islam, which in this day and age, in which the conflicting aspects are more talked about, I think there is a lot of similarities there.
And I think that's a great way to end.